Hey folks, I am having my wedding this Saturday, so we're going to be running a series of greatest hits shows for the next few weeks.
Please consider supporting Chinatalk at chinatalk.substack.com or patreon.com/chinatalk. You'll get an ad-free feed and my eternal gratitude. All the best. Hello and welcome to China Econ Talk. I'm your host, Jordan Schneider, here today with guest host Athena Cao, a consumer industry investor based in Beijing. So, Mr. Softy and Suzhou? Yes, that was a thing. And boy, what a thing it was. Turner Sparks, rising from humble beginnings as just another English teacher making his way in China, achieved fame and fortune on the back of a catchy jingle and some tasty mobile mango-flavored soft serve. Yet his dreams of a China-wide ice cream domination came crashing down amid a hail of backstabbing regulators, slashed tires, and stolen cones. Today on China Econ Talk, the rise and fall of a mobile ice cream empire. Turner, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me on the show. I love that.
That's quite an opening.
What a great introduction. That's probably the best ever.
So before we get to this epic tale, I'm curious, what was your favorite flavor you guys produced in these Mr. Softy trucks?
Okay, so this flavor, it started out as my least favorite. But then I just trusted everyone that people liked it. And then eventually it was like coffee. Like I grew to like it. So we had this like ice cream that tasted like a rice cake when you ate it. And then on top of it, we put red beans and whipped cream. And It was fantastic. But the sound of it sounds awful to a lot of people. Maybe not all, some people. But everyone in our office loved it. And the first time I tried it, it was like it tasted like I was eating a chalkboard. But then after a while, it really became my favorite. It was fantastic.
Athena, what did we have the other day? It was like a tea flavored milkshake with whipped cream on top.
You had a right liqueur ice cream, I believe.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the ice cream and ice cream adjacent verticals here in China.
Sure.
So yeah, it's exciting stuff. The only other ice cream anecdote I have before jumping into this story was watching a movie the other day. It was this kind of like Harry Potter type tale of like a Chinese movie of like an orphan getting adopted and the stepmom was really mean. And there was this scene where they were like some guest was coming over to check on the orphan kid. And the evil stepmom gave both kids little cups of Haagen-Dazs. But as soon as the person left, the mom was like, there is no world in which I'm going to spend money to let you eat Haagen-Dazs. That is some expensive stuff. And only my like super mean son, not this lame orphan who has no business in my life, has any right to eat the Haagen-Dazs stuff. So a lot of interesting class consciousness going on when it comes to ice cream products and Chinese cinematic history.
Well, I agree with her on, just to stop you, I agree with her in one sense. Haagen-Dazs is too expensive. They should have used Mr. Softy.
Seriously. It's unbelievable how incredibly overpriced it is. I think there's like a...
I'll take the mean mom side for a minute.
So how much was Mr. Softy in Suzhou?
Mr. Softy was cones, like a vanilla cone, was 6 RMB. And then our most expensive product was a banana split or banana split, which was 25 RMB. And then all of our shakes and sundaes and like dipped cones and our blasts, which were like the blizzards, everything was right in like the 8 to 15 range for the most part.
So Turner, when did this stroke of brilliance of bringing Mr. Softy to China strike you?
Well, thank you. It struck in, I think it was 2005. I was there. I'd moved to China in 2004, and then I was teaching English, as you said. And then I had, let's see, there was a, like they used, I don't know if they still do, but they would have on all the like the Bushinjes in the cities, all the walking streets downtown, they would have these, McDonald's had these like windows. They would have the McDonald's, but then they would have a window next to it where they sold the ice cream. And they would have, and then Kentucky Fried Chicken, I mean, KFC had those. And basically, all of those in Suzhou, at least, they had these huge long lines at all times of the year, all times a day, people just waiting for the window to get the ice cream. And so there's two things that struck me about that. One is that there was 25 people at all times waiting to get ice cream. And then the second was that ice cream was so popular that they had to take it outside of the actual McDonald's restaurant because they didn't want people clogging the restaurant just to buy ice cream. And then the third was that was like the highest quality of ice cream available outside of Häagen-Dazs, which you mentioned, which was super expensive. It was 35-40 RMB for an ice cream cone. And while McDonald's was two. And I just thought there had to be some kind of a middle ground, and that Mr. Softy would be something. If people were this excited about just getting a McDonald's soft serve cone, Mr. Softy had a way bigger menu. We had way more to offer. Plus, it was on a truck that we could drive through the city, which would be really cool.
So what was the next step once you had the stroke of genius?
The reason why I kind of connected it with the brand Mr. Softy specifically was my best friend from college was a guy named Alex Conway, and his family started Mr. Softy in the 1950s in Haddonfield, New Jersey, outside of Philadelphia. And it's still a family-owned business today. Like, his dad still owns it. I saw his dad a couple weeks ago. And it's within the family still, and they have now, I think at this point, 650, 700 trucks up and down the East Coast that they franchise. So I knew, once I had the idea, I just talked to Alex about it, but really it was coincidence in the sense that I had this idea, but a lot of times you have ideas and you don't really do anything with them. You're just like, oh, that would be cool. Someone should do this is like the thing that people always say, right? There's no Thai restaurant in this neighborhood. Someone should open a Thai restaurant, but you never think it's you. And then Alex contacted me right about that time through email saying, like, he was a business major in college. And so he had like the mind, and he was contacting me through email, and he's like, hey, we should do some kind of business in China. Like, I'm reading that China is going to be the next big thing. This is in like 2004, 2005. And I was like, I just saw all these people are eating ice cream at McDonald's. Like, why don't we try a Mr. Softy truck? And he was like, all right, yeah, let's talk to my dad. And to us, it was as simple as that. Just let's talk to his dad, and his dad will give us a business. And that's not the way it happens.
So what were the first steps? Presumably, you needed some permit, some regulation. So how did you go about acquiring the government approvals you needed to get going?
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, so it was so much more complicated than we thought. We had to get the local government on board. We also had to get Jim Conway, Alex's dad. He had to agree. And then we had to build a supply chain, all that kind of stuff. So we kind of just tried to do it all at once while telling everybody. Like, I was in meetings with the Suzhou government telling them that we ran Mr. Softy. Jim Conway hadn't even yet agreed to license us Mr. Softy. And then I was in meetings with Jim Conway. He was like, well, I'm not going to do this if it's not going to work. And we're like, oh, no, it'll work. We'll be fine with the Suzhou government. So in the meetings with the Suzhou government specifically, yeah, we had to get a hygiene license. We had to get all the fire stuff. So what they decided, because there had never been a mobile vending unit like what we were looking to do with ice cream trucks, any kind of food trucks, had never happened in Suzhou. So they didn't really know how to regulate it. And we didn't know how they should regulate it either. And so it was a lot of meetings of just us, first of all, explaining to them what we did and then explaining why. I remember their question was like, why? Like, why do you need a truck to sell ice cream? Like, why not a store? You could just do it in a store. And which is a very logical question. Like, if you've never seen an ice cream truck before, you would be like, why is that necessary? Like, you know, there's no like falafel. Like, well, we need to build a castle here. Well, why do you need a castle? Well, like, so we can sell falafels, obviously, you know? Like, it doesn't make sense if you have no history of it. So sure. We got all these.
Well, but that's interesting, Turner, because there are, you know, breakfast trucks all around, and they're probably all illegal. Well, not to offend anyone who own a breakfast truck anywhere, but.
You know, a big overlap again with our China Econ Talk audience.
The breakfast truck guys?
The Jen Bing ladies.
Absolutely, yeah. Jordan, you're such a big hit. Yeah, but it's surprising because I'm sure the government's aware of their existence, at least.
Well, so it's funny. I've never seen a truck. In Suzhou, it's like a person. Speaking of Jen Bing specifically, it'll be like a person. With a little
tricycles.
They didn't have, were they tricycles? Maybe, I guess. Yeah, but those were downtown. So a good, something to note here is that this was in the Suzhou Industrial Park, which was, at that time, it was pretty new. It was the Singapore-China cooperation development right outside of Suzhou, where they were going to build this brand new city with all the regulations and all of the cleanliness and everything of Singapore. but in China, and then Singapore was going to help develop it. And while they had all that stuff downtown, none of it was on a truck. It would be, yeah, maybe on a tricycle, or just like on a stand that, like, with wheels that I remember people would just push the wheels. Like the one in my neighborhood, it was a lady with like a flat cooking, what do you even call that, where the Jim Beam's made on, like the stove top or something. It's not the right word.
The trash can tops.
It was a trash can. Yeah, it was a trash can with like a hot plate on top and with wheels on the bottom. So maybe in Beijing they had cooler looking ones. But at that time in Suzhou, there was no real truck. So what they decided was, first of all, they're like, why do you need this? This is just like, they also were blown away that this sounded like the most dangerous business on earth. Like, you're going to sell ice cream to kids out of a moving, like it was like out of a tank to them, you know, like out of this giant truck that's driving around, and then kids are going to be chasing after you through the streets of Suzhou. Like, no, thank you. Yeah. And so then we showed videos of all the trucks in the United States and how, like,
running over innocent
children.
Yeah,
just blasting through neighborhoods. Yeah. So anyway, they finally decided that the way to regulate us, like, was that we had to have a store, because to be able to tax us, you had to have a location and you had to have an office. As a foreign-owned company, we were a wholly foreign-owned enterprise. And I don't know if this is the same way with Chinese businesses. You guys would probably know better than I would if you've worked with them, but you had to have an accountant in your office, like nuts and bolts of it. You had to have an accountant, you had to have an HR person, and you had to have a fixed location. Like, every business, every foreign-owned company in China, or in Suzhou at least, had to have that. So they decided we needed to have an office and we needed to have a store, and then these trucks could operate as delivery units from the store, even though we all knew what we were doing, but that was the way to, like, to get us to fit into the law.
Sure.
Once they decided that it was a cool idea and they wanted to do it, then they was just figuring out how to make it fit legally. And they worked with us really hard and, like, very creatively to try to figure out how to do it. And that became the way to do it, that we needed to have a store. But there was also stuff like, then we built a store and then they decided, oh, we have to have two stores. So then all of a sudden, like, we have these two ice cream stores, and our idea was to do trucks, but out of necessity, we have to have these stores. So that was kind of how it all came together on that end.
So let's now come to the supply chain process. I imagine this was not a straightforward thing, particularly back in the mid-2000s, setting up all you need to make and serve ice cream. So what was that process like?
So with that, we got pretty lucky, because I think probably a year earlier it would have been next to impossible. But we came along at the perfect time. There was this expo called Hotel XEX in Shanghai, which could still go on. And every year, someone had tipped us off to go to that. And we went to it, and it was like, I think like 80% or more of our supply chain came from that one expo. There was, it was called Hotels, but it was really for any retail food stuff in China, and almost like in the fast food style. And so at that expo, we met our ice cream cone supplier. Like, I remember there was this, like, guy from Guangzhou named Gary Ho, who became like a legend. But he was almost like a carnival barker. He was there and he had these, like, giant bands of ice cream cone machines, like how to make them. And he was in this, like, Cantonese / English / Putonghua. He was, like, yelling at everybody, trying to get them to try his ice cream cones. He was making these really cool, the waffle cones. And at that time, that really struck me, because before that, everyone, McDonald's, KFC, which I think they still do, but everybody was selling the wafer cones. And so we met him there. We met our all of our toppings. There was a company that just sold toppings that was selling there. 2005, 2006 was this time when everybody was trying to get in to China. I guess probably still is, but it was the early on in the days of everyone trying to get in. So all these companies had just set up these operations in China, and this was like one of the first places to go to meet people you could supply to. So all our cups, our spoons, our lids, our bowls, our plates, everything was there. And then the luckiest we got was independent of that expo, we met this American company that was starting to sell soft serve wholesale in China. And they had set up, I think, 6 months before we opened, that we started working on our project, they established their headquarters in Hunan. And these were all guys from Kansas who were taking the milk from their dairies in the U.S. and then putting it into powder form and then taking it to China, remixing it with all of the stuff you needed, and then selling it in liquid form to people like us.
Yeah, let me just give some context here. So basically in China, franchising is a huge thing. Basically every industry you can think of that's to consumers, you can find lots of franchisers, and basically one of their biggest needs every year is to recruit franchisees. So for instance, in the restaurant business, or let's say the food retail business, there are two expos every year, once in the spring and once in the fall, that they'd have nationwide, basically franchisee recruitment during these expos. So the expos serve two purposes. One, to display the new products, the new candies, the new snacks, and the other is to recruit franchisees. And franchising is such a common way to expand your businesses that managing these franchisees also became a huge, I'd say, problem in China. And I think that will also cause a lot of supply chain problems for businesses. And I think that's like kind of foreshadowing what Mr. Softy will run into down the road.
Yeah.
So before we dive too deep into the downfall, let's stick with the rise here. I mean, come on, we haven't hit our climax yet. So let's talk a little bit about the initial rollout. So you have to hire your accountant, your HR person, drivers, presumably. So what was the staffing up process like?
It really just started like how a business would start anywhere, which is you start asking friends like hey, I'm looking for someone who can do this. And our office staff was me and one other person for a very long time. And that, I guess, two other people. We had an accountant and we had an HR person, exactly what we needed. And the accountant came from one of our partners, Jeffrey Tsai. There was three of us. Jeffrey was the guy who owned he owned a cell phone manufacturing company, which I can't remember if I talked about earlier or not. But he was a Chinese guy and he owned this factory and this company, and he had a few accountants, and one of them he thought would be good to help us. And so she came over from his company and started with us. So that was pretty easy and trustworthy because she's worked with him. And then the HR person, it just come from off of a recommendation. We had a friend who had worked in another company and he really liked this person. So I interviewed and she came to work for us. And then the drivers we got from, there was a fair, or not a fair, like a market, I guess you would say, in Suzhou all the time, where people who were looking for jobs could go, and then also companies looking for people could go, and you could rent a booth for a few hundred RMB for the day and just sit there, and 100 people, usually like lower level jobs, but 100, like, people will come up and just kind of ask like, what are you? Can I apply for your job? And I think we picked a couple people based out of that.
Sure.
Because we started with one truck. It was only one truck and one store the first year. So we didn't need too big. We needed a few people to work in the store, and we needed two drivers for the truck to switch off hours.
Sure. So the initial truck experience, how did the people of Suzhou respond?
It was fantastic. Yeah, it kind of exploded right away. So I remember the first day we went to Jinji Lake, which is this kind of tourist area just in the middle of Suzhou Industrial Park. And we'd had the permits and all that. The government gave us the permits for all these different spots around town. We couldn't sell anywhere, but we could sell at these specific spots. One of our spots was at Jinji Lake. There was this fireworks thing going off and this laser light show. We parked our truck there, and it, like, I think 4 or 5 hours, it was just nonstop lines on both windows. Like, we had to open both windows, which we weren't expecting. And then we had to put, it couldn't just be the driver in the truck. We realized right away we needed two people in the truck. We're in America, you just have one, you have a driver. In China, we needed two because the business was so, there was so much business that you needed to be pumping everything out as much as you could. And then also on our first truck, we had a soft serve ice cream machine that we thought would be fine for the next trucks. And then from then on out, we had to go with the more expensive machine because it could pump out, it could go nonstop. Like, we needed to up our game on everything, all of our production side.
So from very early on, it was clear that there was a real product market fit, and expansion was definitely in the offing.
Yeah, it was day one, because it was like there was no ramp up time needed because people saw this truck. It looked really cool. They saw people eating ice cream, and like you didn't have to explain to the general public what you were doing. It was just like, whoa, that's cool. We know what ice cream is. We see that truck. And then we found out that a lot of people told us they had seen ice cream trucks in movies. And so that was different.
Thanks, Hollywood.
Exactly, right? And so then there's a real difference between the like the 65-year-old guy in that you're in a meeting with down at the government, like the grandpa, versus the 20-year-old college students who are actually the ones eating your ice cream on the street, you know, and sure. What they're exposed to is wildly different. And those, and so the, our actual demographic, they knew what it was.
Is there one scene that everyone referred to of from any particular movie? I think like Bad News Bears has a ice cream truck scene or something.
I'm not sure. There wasn't one specifically. You know what? I'm trying to think, because there was, even as we were going, anytime a new movie come out, I remember like the, was it The Good Guys or the Other Guys, which was like this Will Ferrell buddy cop movie, had a Mr. Softy truck in it. And then when that happened, all these people told us they saw it in that. And then like customers would tell you, like, I just saw Mr. Softy yesterday in this movie. And then in, I don't think a lot of like our audience watched this, but my friends did, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, there was like this entire episode about the Mr. Softy truck. Oh, and then a lot of, this is interesting, like our expats from like Europe all knew it from this old Eddie Murphy bit. Eddie Murphy in like 1982 has this Mr. Softy like thing. And so everyone was surprised. But there would always be these little bumps along the way where people would find out about it or like say they knew it.
Huh.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? There was also, I want to say, sorry, last thing. Was it Spider-Man? That was a big one. He's wearing a Mr. Softy t-shirt. I might be getting the superhero wrong, but like the high school version of whatever this superhero is, like early in the movie, he's wearing a Mr. Softy shirt. And whenever that happened, that movie played in China and people were flipping out because it was our logo on this spider. And they were like, how did you do this? Like, how much did you pay to make this happen? And they're like, nothing. They just think it's cool. I don't know. Yeah, it has this kind of like cool factor on the East Coast of the U.S. I'm not sure where you guys are from, but in certain places, New Jersey and New York, it's in the culture.
And that's really before social media took off in China.
Yes. Yeah. So that would have been great. But it wasn't. No, it was just people just showing us their phones or showing us pictures. All these people took pictures of their TV screen and then were showing them to us.
That's great.
Yeah. It kind of took off. And then another thing we noticed, which I thought was really cool and I was really happy with, was that because it happens in America. In America, in the New York and New Jersey and the East Coast, Northeast, people refer to Mr. Softy as like a person. Whereas like McDonald's, they're like, hey, let's go to McDonald's. Or like any restaurant, they're like, let's go to that restaurant. But Mr. Softy, they're like, oh, he's coming. Like I hear Mr. Softy, he's down the street, you know? And I always really liked that because it shows the connection people have to the company and they feel like it's a part of their life. And then I noticed that pretty early, starting at Mr. Softy, people would say like, oh, I saw Mr. Softy yesterday. He was like on this street. And I just really enjoyed that overlap, that connection with the brand. And it's really kind of the way it developed in Suzhou. It was this like thing that really became part of, for 10 years, we were part of the local culture of Suzhou.
You know, speaking of that, it just struck me now that lots of somewhat big brands nowadays are called Mr. Something. Maybe that's a tribute to you guys.
It might be. I don't know. It started in 1956. So, yeah, it could be a Mr. Softy spinoff. I don't know if they take 100% credit, but you never know. Mr. Donut, isn't that? That's like a Philippines thing. But, yeah. And so then, that plus what we didn't really think about when we first started but became a big part of our business was corporate stuff. We would go, I remember Bosch, that company Bosch, the German company. At one point we gave out, I think 3,000. They would hire us. All these companies would hire us just to give ice cream to their employees for the day. Like just come and then give them a bill, give the company a bill at the end of the day and however much people want, like free ice cream to everybody and how much they wanted, they would pay for it. And I remember at Bosch, I was there for this one event one day and I really started to worry because I was like, this company's not going to believe how much we're giving away. And they were cool with it. Bosch is totally cool. I remember we gave out 3,000 ice cream cones, I think in 2 hours.
Jesus.
Yeah. We had two trucks and it was just nonstop. So we did that. We got the schools. We would go to all, like, when the schools would have fun runs or whatever, we would go and we would donate and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we really got into the culture.
So we have this this dramatic growth. You guys raise some money, expand to bring some more trucks in, bring some new drivers in. But the pains of growth begin to creep into Mr. Softee's joints and bones, so it seems.
Yes. Well, it's funny you mentioned franchising earlier because we dipped our toe in that a little bit. There were two people who were good and then two or three that it was just a disaster. And the disaster part was way more frustrating. I ended up spending so much of my time just trying to make sure our franchisees weren't ripping us off. It was difficult. Can I ask you a question? Like, what's I know we're detouring here, but what have you seen that's successful, and how do they do it? What's like the in a I know that's a long question, but if there's like any tricks that we never learned. On franchising.
Right. So people really go for franchising for two things. One, they want to expand faster, but they don't have enough people to really do it themselves. Two, they're going for the franchising fees. So it sounds like you guys were going for, you know, the first, which is to really grow faster. And that's really hard if you're just managing people. It's easier today because WeChat has become such an infrastructure in China. And you also have apps like Alipay, which really allow you to naturally avoid people paying with cash because cash is the hardest thing to track.
Yeah.
And now if you're paying, you know, on your phone, either with Alipay or WeChat Pay, you go through a centralized system, and basically if all the money go back to the company first and then you share whatever the proceeds or the profits with your franchisees, that's the easiest way to do it. But before we have all the new infrastructure now, the way to do it is really to manage the people, and you have to make sure you're recruiting people you can count on. And that's really hard.
Yeah, well, we had the way we did it, just if we can get into that for a minute, was we knew we couldn't regulate their sales, and so we decided to become the supplier for the product. And that worked with some people, but ultimately it didn't work overall because they were just finding out other places to get the product or get like different versions of our product.
Could you talk a little bit about the ways you tried to control this and the fun and creative schemes that these franchisees found to get around your controls?
Yeah, well, so franchisees and, I mean, our employees might even be more interesting. They were a little more creative. They, I guess if that's the word. Let's see. So the first thing we noticed, because you control your margins, the best way to regulate the business is to control your profit margin. So if it's like, say, for example, this wasn't our numbers. Let's use different numbers. Say 50% is what you want to make, or 55% is what you want to make on each sale. So 55%, if a thing costs $1, then 55 cents should be profit and 45 goes to cost. And then you regulate that number. And if that number dips, instead of you getting 55 cents, you're getting 50 cents, then you know there's some waste going on somewhere. Like if it dips a little bit more or even at that number, you start to investigate where this waste might be coming from. And so that happened with us. And we found that the waste was coming from stealing. And well, stealing's, I don't know if it's the word. Well, I guess so what we always did from day one was we regulated
leakage.
Sure. So what we regulated from day one was that number, that profit margin. And then every morning we would count all of the inventory going out. We had a manager who would count all of the, so say you have 100 ice cream cones on your truck in the morning. And then during the day you sell 60 ice cream cones. When you get back at night, you should have 40. So we had someone who counted the number at the morning and someone who counted the number at night. And then as long as that checked out, everyone goes home, you're fine. And so what we had gotten, I think, tipped off by someone that people were buying their own cones, at these drivers, and then so that they could come back with the right number, they would sell a bunch of their own cones during the day, and so then they would still come back with the right number. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Sure.
Okay. And so what we started to do was, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go out in the middle of the day. So we'll count the cones in the morning, 100, and I'll go out in the middle of the day and see how many cones are on the truck. So I'd pop up at 1 in the afternoon, and instead of 100 cones on the truck, there'd be like 130 cones on the truck. And so that's an issue, because the number should be less. It shouldn't be more. And so then we put GPS on the trucks, and we found that they had a couple of the guys had this we tracked their movement, and instead of going straight to their spot, they were going to this weird location when they would leave our office, and then they would go to their spot, and where they were going was to this warehouse to pick up all this extra product they had. And so, and initially it was just cones, because they bought their own cones, but then they sold our ice cream, our toppings, all of our stuff in the cone, and then they would keep the money. So then when we cut out the cones, once we figured that out, we fired a bunch of people, and then we solved the cone issue. Then they started buying their own ice cream mix. And again, this is a big problem, because it wasn't necessarily, I think it was the same brand that we were buying, but they had found it from some third party somehow. But, oh yeah, so they were buying somehow from some third party. And then it was the same brand. I'm just remembering. So it was the same brand. And so then they had learned not to have more on the truck than they had started with. So they would sell a bunch in the morning, and then someone would bring, and they knew they couldn't go back to their warehouse, so they would have someone bring them.
Jesus.
To have someone bring them ice cream mix. And so then it would always be less, and they wouldn't go to that warehouse. So we worked with our ice cream mix supplier, where our ice cream mix supplier, they put a little stamp, like a little note on all of our ice cream mix boxes that they sent to us, but not that they sent to anyone else, or not that they sold online, or that they sold anywhere. And so then we could tell if it was from our supplier or not from our supplier. And we never told our employees that. And I don't think they ever knew, because then we caught a bunch of people that way.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of their salary they were able to supplement by doing these sorts of schemes?
It was a lot. Yeah, because I know at one point, our profit margin, when we first started doing, when we first caught the guys with the cones, on a few of these trucks where they were doing that, our margins went up by 10%. So that means that they were making 10% of sales. So if a truck on a weekend, a truck could sell 10,000 RMB. I mean, man, I'm trying to remember correctly, but yeah, like a normal weekend, a truck could do 10,000 RMB in a day. Am I off on that? Man, I don't know if I'm off on that, because it's been a while since I've done the business. But if, for example, they could say average 10,000 RMB, so then that driver would make 1,000 that they would put into their pocket that day.
And what was their salary?
Salaries, I think, were like 5,000 a month.
Sure.
Something like that.
For a full-time job?
Full-time job, yeah. And a lot of these guys were previously long distance truck drivers. And so we were paying them a little more than what they would make doing that job. And they wouldn't have to be on the road all the time. They could stay at home. And that seemed to be pretty attractive. And then also, I think being able to make 1,000 RMB when the boss didn't know was also probably pretty attractive.
Hey there, China Talk listeners. This is Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Jill Weisenthal, and we are the co-hosts of Bloomberg's Odd Lots podcast.
Yep, and if you enjoy China Talk, we think that you'll like Odd Lots too.
We have engaging conversations on everything from semiconductors to trade to AI to macroeconomic policy, and we always have the perfect guest.
Yep, you can check us out at Odd Lots on all the podcast platforms or Bloomberg.com/Odd Lots.
So interestingly, some of these drivers, once you catch them, didn't necessarily go back to long distance truck driving, but started up on their own.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of them. So then you mentioned the slashed tires. One day we fired these two brothers, and then the next day I went home, and I didn't think anyone knew where I lived. But I went home the next day and went to bed. And when I woke up the next morning, all the tires on my car were slashed. inside my apartment complex. So they got pretty upset. And then one guy came in one day and threatened to kill everyone in the office, but I was gone. So he didn't, there was only like three or four people at that time in the office. It was all, they were all women, and he threatened to kill everyone. And then somehow he left, and then they called the police, and the police said, we can't do anything until he actually kills you. So it was wild. It was nuts. And so, but they did. So then they told us to put bars on the windows, which was also good because it's not like it came in through the window. But but we did put a security system in at that point and all that kind of stuff. So then, yeah, they opened up these other trucks.
I don't know. So then you start to run into a number of government relations problems alongside of these employee management issues.
Yes. So then. So basically, as you said, a lot of these people we had had to fire for stealing from us, they would pop up a couple weeks later with a truck.
So alongside these employee management issues, you also run into a number of government relations problems, it seems.
Yes. So just to end the employee thing. So a lot of these guys, when they would steal from us and then we would fire them, they would open a truck a couple weeks later that kind of looked like a bootleg version of our truck, is the best way to say it. So it wouldn't be, it would be the cheapest version of the ice cream, of an ice cream machine, and cheaper, not our same products, but like a cheaper product that they could sell, kind of like a less expensive version of everything, and like a used truck. And then, but it would sort of look like our truck, and it would have a slightly different, it would have a different name, but in our font, whatever. I have a bunch of pictures of these. And they would park right next to our trucks. And when I first saw that, I just thought, oh, that's fine. Let's just call the government and tell them, or the Chengguan, which is like the street regulation police. I don't know the exact term. City Management Bureau, I think they call themselves. And we'll call them and they'll get rid of those people because they don't have a permit. We did have a permit and they didn't have a permit. So it seemed pretty simple. But then they didn't. These people didn't go away, and they weren't being... The local government was not enforcing it, not regulating them, not asking them to move. And so then it was affecting our business, just in the sense that if someone's doing your exact same business, and when I say right next to us, I mean within inches, they would almost to antagonize us, they would park within 6 inches of our truck. And if we had a line of 10 people regularly, then you're going to get a percentage of those people are going to go to the other truck when the line's too long, whatever. So it does cut your business down. And also selling the exact same products named the same. So they would even use, just copy and paste our menu. And so we had a Softy Blast, which is like a Blizzard. And on their truck, they had a Softy Blast. It was called the same thing. And so we called the government. We asked them to just regulate, and they wouldn't do anything. And they kind of disappeared. Like they wouldn't really, they would answer our phone call and be like, okay, well, I'll get back to you. And then just wouldn't get back to you. And you wouldn't be able to get in touch with them for a few months. And the same thing through email. They wouldn't get back.
Like, do you think them ghosting on you is related to that one episode when they called you in to say you need to bribe them more and you walked away?
Oh yeah. So we didn't talk about that. That did happen. A couple years earlier, the Tax Bureau had asked me to bribe them. I feel comfortable saying that because that's exactly what happened. And I didn't do it. I didn't give them any money. And then that was kind of the end of it. It was right. They said, if you don't bribe us, we'll audit you. And as a foreign invested company, you get audited every year anyway. And we were a completely above board that we weren't doing anything wrong. So I was like, go ahead, audit me. Like I just had this like dumb confidence. And we passed the audit. Everything was fine. But that taxpayer wasn't happy. But to answer your question, no, I don't think that they were directly related because they were in different parts of town. They were different bureaus. I don't think they worked together, but I guess I could say that I think that the Tax Bureau people's thing was that if we paid them money directly, they wouldn't check our taxes, and then therefore we could not pay as much tax. So I think they were just two separate issues. Because if you don't have to pay tax anymore, you can make a lot more money. Yeah, obviously, as we all know.
Right, but that's pretty crazy. You're paying the full taxes.
It's crazy that we paid it?
Yeah, because it's a 17% tax.
Yeah.
And you paid all that.
We paid 100% of our taxes. Yeah, because I had, and it was a cash business. So you're right, we didn't necessarily have to. but I was just paranoid the whole time that we were a foreign business and we also were getting audited every year, which is true, and that we were gonna, if we did anything incorrectly, like I didn't want to give the local government any excuse to kick us out. So,
you paid insurance for all your workers.
Yes. Yeah. We paid insurance for everybody. We paid, and in Suzhou, there was this, I think in 2008, there, after the financial crisis in the world, they had built way too many apartments in Suzhou and not enough people were living in them. So they came up with this new tax, I guess, or this, where 20% of an employee's salary every month went into a fund that could only be used to buy an apartment in Suzhou. And then on top of that, we had to pay an extra 20% of their salary that also went into that fund. So we're paying, your salary all of a sudden is 120% of what it, or 20% above what it was previously, like overnight. We paid everything. We did everything 100% by the book the entire time.
Model CEO over here.
Yeah, except not...
Like good guys always lose.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not exactly a model CEO if we went out of business, but... Yeah.
I'm going to say that after seeing so many consumer companies, it's very hard to stay in business if you're paying all the five types of insurances that the government wants you to pay on top of that 17% tax rate.
Yeah.
Which is a huge amount, comparatively speaking. And in some cases, you have an additional 6% tax on that. So if you're paying all of that and you're still in business, like that's an industry that's obviously going to be reformed somehow because the margin's too high. So basically, you can't win in this situation.
How is that? How can you not win?
So if you're still making a profit after the tax, after the insurances, so basically your labor costs and your tax are already pretty high,
yeah,
and you still have margins left, that means you don't have enough competition in the industry, and that means this industry is too outdated.
So someone's going to end up starting to cheat on their taxes and insurance and undercut you is the idea?
Well, usually that happens. And oftentimes startups, and this is the part that's really hard for foreign business to take advantage of. So basically there's a thing called a small taxpayer type that allows you to pay only 3%. Basically you save, you know, up to 14% of tax.
Yeah.
And that could be pure profit.
And that's what all of our franchisees were allowed to do that. So they could all pay the 3%. And truthfully, a lot of them, I didn't even know if they paid that, but they were supposed to, right? And that wasn't really up to us. But they were all the small taxpayer, and we didn't, I think we were maybe like our first year. And then once we priced out of that, it became a big issue. And we couldn't figure out what to do about that. But what do most companies do then if they're not paying the taxes like we paid?
They do exactly what you did. They franchise the independent stores out to the franchisees or the truck drivers, or in some cases they franchise their stores to their own employees. So the tax burden's on the individual, not the company.
And then the company's job is now they're just a full-time franchisor. They just regulate franchises.
They could be a brand management company, or they could be a supply chain company.
Yeah, gotcha. Sort of like what we did with the supply chain.
Right.
Yeah.
This is all contingent, of course, upon franchisees who will not slash your tires and steal ice cream cones.
Well, to be fair, those people were not franchisees. Those were our employees.
Oh.
So then these guys also weren't getting regulated locally by the local government. And then they didn't have all the licenses. They didn't have hygiene licenses. We figured out they didn't have a hygiene license. They didn't have, obviously, this mobile vending license that we had been given. They didn't have, but they weren't being regulated, which was pretty frustrating. And it started out as one, and then when nothing happened to them, all of our drivers kind of ended up with their own trucks, and then it sort of became chaos. And after some time of us continually calling the local government, all we were asking them to do was enforce their own regulations. So we were saying, we have this permit. These other guys don't have the permit. Just enforce that. Just take them off the street unless they get a permit. And then if they get a permit, like, there's nothing we can do about that. But if they don't, just enforce your own law. And the SIP government got so sick of us asking them to enforce their own law with a permit that they came to a decision, and their decision was just to take away our permit, so we couldn't complain anymore.
Jesus.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Thank you. It's fine. It's been I've moved past it. But it's well, I take away is maybe not the right word, but they didn't renew. So we had 1 year permits that were basically, if we didn't run over kids and all that kind of stuff, they would renew every year. And for the longest time, it was really fine. And then once we started complaining for a while about these other trucks, they just decided not to renew it. But the worst part with that was they didn't tell us they weren't going to renew it. They just said, you don't have a permit for now, but hold on, because this year we have a new system that's going to incorporate all these other trucks. And that was just a lie. They never had a new system. There was never a plan. They kind of just didn't want to tell us to go away. They didn't want to face us directly. And so instead, they just thought we would take the hint. And that took a couple years because I was waiting on this new system that they were never going to do. And then finally, once we figured that out, we closed up shop and left. And but also, it wasn't even that cut and dry, because we were allowed to operate. They said, okay, you guys aren't going to have permits for now because we're coming up with a new system, but also still park in all your same spots. And we're not going to, the police aren't going to be coming around giving you fines like parking tickets or anything. We're still going to let you operate as normal, but we're letting all these other trucks operate as normal as well. And now you can't complain because you're all on the same playing field because none of you have permits. So that took a lot of our power away. And then after about a year of that, and or maybe more, and waiting on these permits, we started getting fined by the police. And the police started giving us parking tickets for being in our spots. And when we would take it to the government, sometimes they would be like, oh, okay, cool. Well, sorry, we'll get rid of that. And then it would go away. And then, but more and more that wasn't happening. They just wouldn't answer, or they would say, yeah, we don't know, we'll check on it. And they wouldn't check on anything. And then it was like, all right, well, now we're just getting, like, we're not a business anymore. You know, this is just something illegal that, like, we're getting fined every day. So that's what we decided to close.
So, Athena, how do other companies and try to handle these sorts of government relations issues?
So basically two ways businesses deal with this. One way is to hire someone in-house to take care of all the government relations problems that you could possibly face. And you really want to take care of these relationships from the get-go, because you want to let the fire department know, you want to let the FDA, so the department that hands out the hygiene certificates, and you want to let the environmental department know as soon as you settle down into a store or you have a truck. You want to know that you will comply to their laws and regulations. And basically this in-house person is not doing anything rocket science. He's just there to, you know, hand the government person a cigarette when that person feels like, you know, some extra attention, or takes that person out to dinner once in a while, gives that person a gift, you know, before the big holidays. It's really the little things, because in China there's a saying that basically goes like, the lower in the government ranking you're in, the bigger ego you tend to have. So these are government people who don't have a whole lot of power, but they really want to feel respected by, I guess, the constituents in their district or the businesses. So that's one way. The other way is, you know, since so many businesses run into this problem, there are now third-party vendors who promise to take care of these businesses for you. And those people tend to have some relationships with certain government departments. Maybe the relatives of a certain department head, or, you know, an old boss of someone's in the government department. So that's generally the two ways.
That would have been amazing if that was available at the time, like a third party company, because the definite cultural I guess divide there, but I remember being aware of all, like what you're saying, being aware of that at the time and not knowing how to fix it. So we did, there was a guy like in a different district of Suzhou. We had one truck in this other district of Suzhou, and the government guy that I kind of had to work with down there was this dude I became friends with, and we would hang out every once in a while. I remember he loved to golf. Like, we go golfing sometimes, and we go get dinner sometimes. But he was maybe 40 years old, and he traveled and was just like, we had stuff in common, you know? And so I was happy to like hang out with him and kind of do what you said. Like, it wasn't, it was just like, we just knew each other. And then that's everything worked fine down there. And then just the people, I would go meet with people in the Suzhou Industrial Park, and it just happened to be the people I was meeting with, I just had nothing in common with. And I'm like, I want to take you out to dinner. And even if I was to go out to dinner with them, it was like comical. I think we went out like one time. I'm like, what do we even talk about? What are we doing here? We have nothing.
So was it just that they just didn't like your ice cream?
That was probably... No, they love the ice cream. They liked it too much. They wanted their own. But you're right. So if there would have been someone I could have hired, I remember talking to a friend who owned a bigger business in Shanghai, and he was like, oh yeah, I just have this like old guy on staff. He's like a retired government dude. He's like 70 and he's literally on my staff, but he never comes to work. And it's just whenever I need meetings like this done, he does it. And that would have been great. I would have loved someone like that. I just didn't know where to, like, what do I do? Just like go find, excuse me, like old guy. Hey, do you want to come? Do you know anybody?
You should have just asked every single elderly man who showed up to buy ice cream, being like, so, like, need a guanxi zimian.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. But you're 100% right. And this was a mistake on my end. This was a part of the culture that going in as a 22-year-old, 24-year-old, whatever I was, who wants to start a business, you don't even consider that aspect of it. And I definitely should have. Once I kind of knew about all that, I felt like it was almost too late and I didn't know how to fix it.
So this government relations thing, it is a real job. It's not like you see someone you like today and you happen to be friends and that part of the business is taken care of. And they don't have to be, you know, government veterans. If you find one, well, lucky you, that's going to take care of a whole lot of businesses for you. But if you don't find one, there are actually people who are maybe our age or maybe, you know, 30-some, 40-some, don't have to be too old. But basically, if they've been doing this for a while in the local district, they know who they're talking to in the local government. And these tend to be very down-to-earth people who, they're kind of like salespeople. They just kind of, you know, make people like them. And it's not like they have to be best friends with the local government. They just have to be very humble and make the local government feel like they're somebody.
It's so funny. It's almost like you're describing a lobbyist, like in the US.
You know, that might be exactly that, but not as sophisticated as, you know, you're not pitching like a policy change. You're pitching for them to just take it easy.
Give you a break every once in a while.
Screw you.
Exactly. Not to screw you. That's a demand, yeah. Basically. Yeah. You're not even asking for them to break the law for you.
Yeah. 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 Well, that's what we were. We weren't asking them to break the law. It's just like, just enforce the law you have.
So now, Turner, you are a comedian touring across America. I'm curious, you know, has the rise and fall of the ice cream empire given you a broader perspective on life? Did it bring out your tragic comic side? How long a bit can you pull out of this experience?
I do talk about it on stage. It's not all I talk about on stage, but I do talk about it. It's I'm going to start talking about it more. It's almost like you need a little bit of distance to talk about it, but I have about 10 minutes of, so when I headline, I do like an hour, and I would say 10 minutes or so is on the Mr. Softy stuff. And there might be more in the future, but then I also talk about transitioning back to the US, being someone that's gone from your own country for 12 years. And then all of a sudden you're back and like, everything's different. That's a big part of my life now. And also when I came back at this crazy time right before the 2016 election. America's insane right now. So that relates. There's a fine line of what people are interested in that doesn't relate to them at all. And that seems to be right now about 10 minutes of stuff. And then you want to, people want to at least feel like they're part. People want to hear about you in a comedy setting, but also they kind of want to hear about them a little bit. And I did notice when I first came back, because I'd been doing comedy for 6 years in China. That's the other half of my story is I started a comedy scene and opened this comedy club with a friend. And so I had a comedic background for a long time. I was touring all over Asia as a stand-up. And then when I came back, you find that people want to hear about that for a little while. And then they're like, okay, but that can't be like, tell us, also relate to us on some level, you know? So I kind of mix it. I mix it in would be the best way to put it.
So we can't just let this topic pop by without a one or two follow-up questions. So starting up a stand-up comedy scene in Suzhou. So what was the market like? How did you kind of educate people? Had anyone seen hour-long specials before, or was there enough of a Xiangshou overlap that people sort of got what you were doing? How did you kind of kickstart it there?
The fun thing about starting that was that there was no strategy, it wasn't a business, it wasn't anything. It was just my friends and I wanted to try stand-up comedy, and another friend opened a bar, and so we're like, let's put on a night and see what happens. And all of our friends came down, and it was, so to answer your question, it was mostly expats who had some familiarity, and also Chinese people who had lived, I don't know, somehow seen stand-up comedy and spoke English because it was in English. And this was like 2009 and the end of 2009. But at no point was it ever a business. There was no like big strategy behind it or meetings or anything like that. It was literally just people getting together and having fun. And it slowly, gradually, very gradually over the course of a number of years turned into something that became the Kung Fu Comedy Club in Shanghai and a tour that I ended up running and performing on that lasted for years. 2012 to like 2000. I mean, it just stopped a few months ago where we would go around to different cities around China with headliners from the United States or the United Kingdom or whatever. And we would open for them and they would headline, and we would do all these. We set up all these kind of shows in, Chengdu, Beijing, Suzhou, Shanghai, Wuxi, Nanjing, Hangzhou, Ningbo. That might be it, but we were all over the place. And so it was always more of a hobby than anything else. And it really didn't become, even when I was touring around Asia, I would go tour and do all these different countries, and I'd be gone for like 4 or 5 days or less even, because then I would come back and I was Mr. Softy. I was running Mr. Softy. So it didn't become like a full-time, what I do full-time, and kind of until it had to be out of necessity. And that was when January of 2016, we officially closed Mr. Softy. And then I was like, all right, well, this is what I do for a living now, so I better figure out how to make a living out of it. And that's why I moved to New York later in 2016. And then I've just been doing stand-up every night in New York City since then, and then going on the road and making my money that way, making a living as a stand-up comedian on the road and with my podcast and all that kind of stuff. So it was fun in the sense that there was never a meeting about strategy or anything. It was just so different from what I was doing as my day job, you know, my main job, Mr. Softy.
Sure. It's interesting watching the scene and the kind of familiarity with it really develop over the past few years. I mean, like iQIYI and Youku now have giant reality shows like China's new favorite stand-up comic.
It's crazy.
And whatnot. So definitely not something that was around, circa 2009.
No,
for sure.
What's crazy. Yeah. We were the first. So when we started that show, that was the first show, first stand-up show in China. I mean, maybe there had been something a long time ago that we didn't know about, but at that time, there was no other stand-up in China. And then Beijing came, Shanghai came about a year and a half after us, and then Beijing came shortly after them, and then down in Xinjiang, and then it just kind of, Chinese and English, it just kind of exploded. And it's nuts because there was people, it moves so fast in China, as we all know. Like, there would be people that I would see at these Chinese language open mics at our comedy club in Shanghai. I saw them like two or three years ago. And then my wife and I went back for Chinese New Year, and just this past year, and they were on, like, we turn on TV and they're on this like major TV show doing a roast of somebody. And I was like, holy crap. Like, that's the kid who started open mic 2 years ago. Like, 2 years. It's crazy how quick it goes. And they're all famous now. It's really cool.
Good for them. You just got to ride the right wave.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's awesome. And they got in before anyone else did. And they had this creative gene in them to try out this new crazy form of art, I guess. So it's very cool.
Turner, thanks so much for coming on China Econ Talk.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast. Great to meet both of you. Really interesting conversation.